perfect shoulder wise. Also, with your head slightly forward, the back of the jacket tends to come down here. So we lengthen the back neck of the jacket half an inch to compensate for that.
Karl Marx referred to clothes in Das Kapital as social hieroglyphics, and hieroglyphics can be difficult to decipher, as is clearly evidenced by books about fashion, which present Rosetta Stone-style levels of interpretative challenge to the non-expert. Standard texts on the meaning of fashion include Roland Barthes' The Fashion System and Thomas Carlyle's Sartor Resartus, books which one would hardly wish on one's worst or even worst-dressed enemies. Barthes doggedly stalks and pursues the sign systems of fashion through over 300 pages of dense structuralist prose, only to conclude that the rhetoric of fashion is impoverished, limited, and the whole subject hardly worth the bother. In Sartor Resartus, Tailor Retailored, Carlyle sets out to investigate the moral, political, even religious influence of clothes in a convoluted, enfolded narrative concerning one Diogenes Teufelsdrock, meaning devil's dung. Carlyle seems to be mocking Teufelsdrock's attempts to read the world through clothes and having a satirical dig at Hegel along the way. But, as with Barthes, one remains unclear at the end of the book whether what has gone before is a work of utter genius or a load of old flapdoodle. The problem with trying to read clothing in a systematic way, as Barthes and Carlyle attempt to do, is that clothing is not a language. Clothes mean what they are. They are not a code to be cracked, but rather things, products, material. Suits, one might say, do not have fixed meanings. They have histories, and they have implications. We should, of course, attend to such implications, since implications can have consequences. Take President Barack Obama's suits, for example. Obama wears Hart Schaffner Marx two-button Italian-cut suits, usually of solid navy, 97% worsted wool, 3% cashmere, with pleated trousers with an inch and a quarter turn-ups. The jackets are a 40-inch long, trousers are 33 regular. He matches his suits with plain white shirts and plain ties knotted small and tight, with just a little dimple and no pocket handkerchief. When he appeared on the David Letterman show in America back in 2007, Letterman remarked, "That is a very electable suit." He was absolutely right. Obama, in his suits, as in his rhetoric, trim, composed and neat, made his opponents look bloated and flat-footed in comparison. Over here in the United Kingdom, at the recent Conservative Party conference, David Cameron wore a suit that made him look like an estate agent on a night out. And Gordon Brown has looked for a long time like a regional sales manager in court on charges of drink driving. Yet both Brown and Cameron wear expensive bespoke. Cameron's conference speech suit reportedly cost in the region of £3,500. Obama's suits are available in good department stores in the States for approximately $1,500. What works for one man, though, does not necessarily work for another. If Cameron or Brown were to wear an Obama-style suit, with its long tapering lapel and deep V opening to the waist, it would look at best unseemly and at worst ridiculous. They need to find, or perhaps alas they have already found, some style that reflects their true inner selves. Or, alternatively, they need to find a suit that makes and remakes an inner self for them. The appeal of the suit, I suppose, derives at least partly from our fantasy that outer forms might not only reflect, but also somehow determine our inner condition. I am what I wear, rather than I wear what I am. Which is why the suit I'm looking for has a fitted jacket, waistcoat, high-waisted trousers with an English back for braces, and a fairly heavy cloth and lining in solid dark colours, because I want my suit to suggest that I may have studied at the Warburg Institute with A.B. Warburg, or at the Frankfurt School with Theodore Adorno, or indeed that I am, in fact, Isaiah Berlin, delivering a lecture on the two concepts of liberty at the height of the Cold War, with nothing standing between me, civilization, and chaos, but good taste, common sense, and my rooms at the Albany, a convenient short walk from my tailor's. Basically, I want the suit of an aging European intellectual. I want the suit to suggest that I am truly a Weltbürger, a citizen of the world, a thinker who holds some sway, rather than, as seems to be the case, a mere l'homme moyen or tout le monde, living in the suburbs of the provinces, far removed from the centres of power and intellectual debate. I don't want my suit to reflect the real me. What I want is to create an illusion.
The perfectly cut suit starts with the tailor who is measuring you. All these things that maybe you don't notice about yourself, and we don't necessarily tell you either. We write it down in the book quietly. Then those measurements and figure descriptions have to be properly interpreted by the cutter.
And so I turn to my tailor. The journalist Robert Elms, a self-confessed clothes horse, describes how a good tailor acts as an interlocutor or a translator, someone who is able to understand and interpret one's dreams and ideals and to make them into a reality. A good tailor will give you what you want, even if you didn't know you wanted it. What I really want, but what I can't explain, is a suit like that worn by my next-door neighbour, George, a man now in his late 80s. Recently, despite being frail and unwell, George sanded down his front door and repainted it wearing a waistcoat, suit trousers, gleaming shoes, and only his wife's apron to protect him. I want George's suit. I want the suit worn by my grandfather when he lived in a tower block in the East End of London, looking down upon the bomb sites all around. I want the suit suggested by those lines of Philip Larkin. Now helpless in the hollow of an unarmorial age, a trough of smoke in slow suspended skeins above their scrap of history, only an attitude remains. What I want is a suit that makes sadness beautiful, that prepares me for the ravages of oblivion. Like Michael Caine, I want a suit for life on the outside. Take me to my maker.
That was Ian Sanson musing on the theme of the suit in a programme produced in Bristol by Sarah Davies. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and to the BBC Proms, where we rejoin an impeccably attired Halle and their equally stylish music director, Sir Mark Elder, live here on BBC Radio 3 and online. There's one more work to come tonight, and it's an orchestral titan, Richard Strauss's tone poem, Ein Heldenleben, A Hero's Life, which, at almost 50 minutes long, is certainly cast on a pretty heroic scale. Strauss wrote the piece in the late 1890s, when he was riding high in terms of his professional reputation. He'd become an accomplished conductor, making a particular name for his Wagner interpretations. A string of tone poems had established him as a composer to reckon with. Operatic fame lay just around the corner, but all this apparent good fortune wasn't quite as smooth as it sounds. He'd had a real mauling from the critics over his first opera, the Wagner-inspired Guntram, and Strauss wasn't one to forgive and forget. That whole experience was just one of the ingredients he stirred into Ein Heldenleben. But was his tongue at least partly in his cheek? Here's what Sir Mark Elder thinks.
I think that he saw himself as an heroic figure against the tumult of potential opposition. And the opening melody, thrusting upwards, is a wry ability to find sounds to portray the creative energy, the creative juices of being a creating genius, which he was. And it's a way of portraying his talent, as it were, his energy as a creator. And from that point of view, I think it's very seriously meant.
Sir Mark Elder. Well, the hero of the title emerges as a fine, upstanding, noble type who's kept busy battling with those pesky critics. Their muttering and grumbling is evoked with a gruff chorus of woodwind, tubas and trombones. But our hero strides manfully onwards, doing battle with the bad guys and winning. Cue a mischievous quote of the horn theme from Don Juan. Finally, he retires from the hustle and bustle of the world to seek ultimate contentment, with his faithful companion by his side, an acute portrait here of Strauss's wife, Paulina, whom he once described as very complex, very feminine, a little perverse, a little coquettish, at every minute different from how she had been the moment before. And he gives a solo violin the job of portraying her lightning changes of mood. Also, Mark was telling me earlier today how beautifully he thinks Strauss paints that portrait of Paulina. It was one of those stormy marriages where friends often wonder just how the partners ever stay together. But Paulina gave Richard love and support, and their union lasted for many years. Strauss was still referring tenderly to their relationship in the four last songs written in the 1940s, with its portrayal of a couple embarking together on their journey towards death. Well, the premiere of Ein Heldenleben in this country was actually conducted by Strauss himself in 1902. Sir Henry Wood was also conducting on that occasion, and Strauss was delighted by the results. A splendid orchestra, an expression of admiration for their performance. Well, here is Sir Mark Elder coming back on stage to rejoin the Halle for tonight's Proms performance of Strauss's Ein Heldenleben.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
retires from the world to find fulfillment with his companion at the end of Strauss's Ein Heldenleben, A Hero's Life. Sir Mark Elder conducted the Halle, led by Lynn Fletcher, and the first great cheer you heard was for her. A cheer too for the principal horn. And plaudits must also go to the woodwind section, kept very busy too, chattering and sniping away as a gang of particularly spiteful critics. And Sir Mark Elder turning to the audience, taking a low bow and sweeping his arm to acknowledge the orchestra and convey his thanks to them. He made his proms debut 35 years ago this year, and his enthusiasm and commitment have never wavered. Enjoying himself hugely during that piece, swaying to the lush romanticism of the score and relishing Strauss's musical sketches of the various characters in what's really, I suppose, a musical drama of sorts. And he's back on stage now. That cheer for the woodwind section, as I mentioned. Plenty to keep them occupied during this piece, and he's working his way around now. Principal horn and the whole of the horn section now. Coming on in unison in a blaze of glory during that final section. And Sir Mark working his way around. Principal trumpet. The rest of the trumpets. The tubas, the two tubas who played an incredibly important role there, and the whole orchestra getting its acknowledgement. Well, as you can hear, the applause echoing to the rafters here at the Royal Albert Hall, but there is more to come tonight. We have another live prom later on. So, for now, I'm going to leave you with those cheers and hand you back to Jill Anderson in Broadcasting House.
Thank you very much. That was Penny Gore at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom again on Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. If you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then visit the prom's website at bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Sarah Moore-Peach there, and she'll be popping up in just a moment. As part of this year's BBC Proms, there's been an event called Inspire. At its heart, a competition for young composers, but a great deal more besides. Sarah Moore-Peach has been following the proceedings and hearing from the composers who've been inspired.
Composing takes real courage. It takes talent, skill and patience too. And it also takes encouragement and the right opportunities. The BBC Proms Inspire competition exists to offer just that to a handful of young composers. Now in its 10th year, the competition gives everyone who enters a chance to take part in a workshop and, for the winners, performances of their works and an ongoing composing commission. In this programme, we're going to be hearing performances of all 6 winning works. And this is the first. Catherine Chung turned 18 this month, and here's her piece for orchestra called Fragmented Expanse.
Thank you.
Fragmented Expanse by Catherine Chung, one of six winning entries to this year's Proms Young Composers Competition. That's the recording that Catherine sent in to the competition. It was made by the symphony orchestra of the school she's at, the Purcell School. The conductor was another pupil, Kerem Hassan. Well, Inspire is an annual competition run by the BBC Proms, and it starts with hundreds of young people from the ages of 12 to 18 sending in their scores. By the end of May was this year's deadline. Come in the middle of June, they'd been whittled down into two shortlists, junior and senior, and a panel of composers came together at BBC's Broadcasting House to choose the winners. I joined them there. Composer animateur Fraser Traynor was the chair of the judging panel.
We'll shortly go through and listen to the junior entries, the 12 to 16 category, and listen to those and discuss all the double shortlisted entries. But before we do that, I thought we should just check over what we're looking for in terms of the judging. Entries are judged on the following criteria: the compositional idea, originality, creativity, and the appropriate technical ability. Judges should be reminded that the competition is open to any style of composition, and it's the above criteria alone that should inform our decisions and discussions, rather than the style of music. Recordings are provided, but it's not the quality of the recording that should be affecting our decision. It's only used as a guide. Performance difficulties, this is an interesting one, shouldn't affect the final decision if the entry is deemed worthy of winning. So, for example, if it's written for a large ensemble or full symphony orchestra, if it has electronics or unusual instruments, we'll try and perform the pieces where possible. But we're not judging them on that. It's purely on the criteria as listed above. There are up to three winners in each category and up to five highly commended in each category.
Chair of the panel of judges, Fraser Traynor. And with that in mind, on a day in June, the listening began. All of the judges sitting around a table with copies of the shortlisted scores and the recordings that had been sent in to accompany them. Catherine Chung's piece, which we heard a moment ago, was one of the winners in the senior age group. And another student at the same school, the Purcell School, Christina Arakelian, was a winner in the junior category. Her choral piece is called New Year.
It was written for the new year to encourage people to look at the good things in life. I was influenced by Thomas Tallis's Sperminalium, and instead of using eight choirs, I used two choirs.
How did you go about writing for voices? I mean, what are the particular challenges that you deal with?
The breathing, because you can't write a very long note since people have to breathe when they're singing, and also not writing things that people can't sing, that is out of their range. That's the two things that I find challenging in writing, but all in all, I really enjoy writing for voices. That's one of my favourite instruments, yeah.
And have you pretty much at this stage decided that you want to be a composer, full stop, or do you have other ambitions?
I think I've pretty much decided I would like to be a composer and pianist. And I would really, really like to make it as a composer in the future.
Thank you.
Young composer Christina Arakelyan turned 16 this month, and that was her winning entry to the Proms Inspire competition. It's called New Year, and that performance was by her school choir, the Purcell School Chamber Choir, conducted by Joy Hill. Well, by the end of the judging day back in June, six winners and six highly commended pieces had been chosen, and a good day had been had by all. Here's Fraser Traynor again and fellow judge composer Peter Weigold.
It's been a fascinating day today to hear all the pieces that have come through the shortlist, and there are some composers there who have really honed and refined a very coherent language.
Is it really that easy to tell from one piece? I mean, I absolutely trust you when you say that it is, but I'm interested to know how what the markers are that give you that sense that someone really has honed their language. I mean, these are young people early on in their what may turn out to be careers or not.
I think it's partly that you're looking for a voice, because you do get plenty of people who've learned tricks. They've learned to do the Baroque or to do the jazz or whatever. And then what I find interesting is the ones who are struggling for the mature things like contradiction or subtext or, you know, the tectonic plate shifting two-thirds of the way through. And they don't often get it at that age, but you sense that's a real composer pulling things around to try and find, you know, lifting up the stones to try and find what's underneath it. And that's what I look for.
I mean, it sounds also as if it's a lot of fun for you and quite a sort of discovery and exploration, meeting the music of, you know, all of these shortlisted composers today.
Well, I really enjoy the whole process, actually. It's really nice to get together today and hear these however many 25 pieces that we've listened to today and to talk about them with other people, other composers, and to try and get inside the mind of the composers who've submitted the pieces. But I also enjoy the bigger process of having a sack full of 100 compositions arrive at my door and really, you know, delving into those. And some of it is a difficult and painful process of hearing a lot of compositions in a row that maybe don't offer that much or they don't quite work overall. But then suddenly something just stands out and it's like being struck by lightning. It's fantastic the way one just jumps out at you and you want to listen to it again and you just hear these wonderful things that have been put together.
Peter Weigold and Fraser Traynor. On the same day, I also talked to the other three composers on the judging panel, Stephen Montagu, Stuart McRae and Tansy Davis. Clearly, there's some subjectivity involved in the judging process, whether a composer is more likely to go for something skillfully imitative or something characterfully original. Or what was more important for each of them? Tansy Davis begins.
Well, I'm always going to be drawn to the more creative, the more inventive, the more ambitious. I'm not too critical of technical, you know, things being unplayable. I won't worry too much about that.
And Stuart, what about you?
I think I tend to fall on the side of favouring pieces that have a lot of ambition, and whether they're successful or not, I tend to appreciate that ambition. But as long as there's an integrity behind it and they're ambitious because the person has a need to express something through it, they may not have all the tools in their toolbox yet to be able to do that. But usually you can get a sense of whether they're actually trying to say something in particular. Whereas something that's a pastiche or is a good imitation of something, I think is a very important learning process and all composers go through it. But it doesn't always create something that's interesting as a piece of music in itself.
And as composers, do you think competitions are helpful and important, or can they trip people up and send them slightly in the wrong direction?
You know, in my experience, they've been very helpful to me. It was very useful to me to send pieces off to competitions because then I heard them and I got to meet people. So, and I think the judges, particularly today, this jury, is a fantastic jury. Really widespread, open-minded, across the board. Everyone is very wise and caring about the future of music. So I think it's very positive.
Steve, do you think it's important for young people to have these sort of competitions to work towards?
I think competitions can be important if you keep it in perspective for what it is. You know, it's terribly subjective. It's what I think before lunch and after lunch. And if you get the result that you came in second, it doesn't mean that it's a second-rate piece, but just that's what the person thought at the time. And I think at any stage in your life, you need some kind of feedback. And it is a way of actually saying, yes, a group of people on a certain day thought that this piece was the best piece that they'd heard on that day. And that's no more than that.
Well, having heard from the judges of the Proms Inspire competition, let's hear another of the winning pieces. Besides Christina and Catherine's works that we've already heard and which will be given performances very soon, all of the others were played by members of the Aurora Orchestra in a Proms Plus event last Monday at the Royal College of Music. This piece is called Switch by William Marshall, who's 17. So what does switch in the title mean?
The switch refers to a sort of low chord that's played on the piano throughout, and it acts as a switch to sort of trigger changes in the rest of the material. It's just sort of an abstract idea. I often find it helpful to think about that sort of thing when you're composing. It sort of helps you to decide where to go with a piece. The piece was originally written for Ensemble 1010, the contemporary music group of the Liverpool Phil. They commissioned 10 young composers to write short pieces to celebrate the birthday of Sir Peter Maxwell Davis. And he actually provided a four-note motif on which we all wrote a piece. And it was interesting seeing, you know, the different ways people used it.
Is that four-note motif something that we hear very early on in the piece? With the solo viola?
Yeah, it's literally the first four notes of the piece.
Nicholas Collin conducting the Aurora Orchestra in Switch, a winning work by 17-year-old William Marshall. That performance was given at the Royal College of Music in a Proms Plus event on Monday. And you might remember at the very beginning of that piece we heard the viola playing a four-note motif which was provided to William for that particular compositional opportunity by Sir Peter Maxwell Davis. We'll hear some Max quoted later on in another winning entry. Well, after the winners had been told the good news, the next significant event in the process of the Inspire competition happened a few weeks ago. The six young composers all met together for the first time, and they were told about the most important aspect of their prize, a commission. Each of the six will be asked to write a short piece for a specific occasion. The common factor is that all of them are events organised by Music for Youth. Chief Executive of Music for Youth, Lincoln Abbotts, told them what they were in for.
On October the 6th, we take over the Royal Albert Hall. We bring in up to 9,000 primary school age children from across London and the South East. We've got two commissions there. One is to open the morning concert, and the other one is to open the afternoon concert. So your audience is 4,500 primary school students. Third commission For the second year running, there will be an event called the London Music Show. It's held at somewhere called Exhal, which is a huge exhibition centre in East London. As part of that, we want to commission one of you guys to write a tuned solo percussion piece. It's a showpiece. Fourth and the fifth one are commissions to take part in the school's prom. There will be a commission for a short piece, and we are talking short piece, that really uses the space, really uses the Royal Albert Hall, and another piece, again, that might be connected to the first one or separate to it, that takes place in the second half. Then the final one there is, it just says participation. What we're after is a piece to involve, some aspect of the piece to involve the audience. Could be singing, could be all standing up at the same time, it could be something rhythmic, it could be something that none of us have thought of, and it'd probably be good if it's something that none of us have thought of, but the agenda would be to send everyone out of that event thinking, wow, that was an amazing performance, and we took part.
So, having put that proposition to the young composers, Lincoln Abbott, a composer himself, and Peter Weigold gave the young winners a few minutes to think of some initial ideas. I caught Peter during a tea break to find out more about what he thought the young composers needed to be taking into account, especially when writing for a space like the Albert Hall.
The most important thing is that they grab the audience. So they've got to know that they've got to open a concert for eight-year-olds with no introduction and grab their attention.
And are they choosing which one they go for, or are you suggesting the pairing of a particular composer with a particular event? Because presumably they come already with quite different skills, interests, tendencies.
We've just now left them to say, of these six choices, what would your number one and number two be? And in 5 minutes, come up with an idea. And then we'll kind of, it's between us and them, we'll discuss it with them and say, well, what if you had five clarinets and five oboes rather than 10 clarinets? Or, you know, what if you started in the middle of the space rather than outside the doors? It's interesting because the one who wrote the most sophisticated and complex discursive composition has just said he'd be quite interested in opening something with the eight-year-olds, with the junior kids. So it's not necessarily what you think. It's more interesting for them and for us to have a dialogue with them about it rather than just go away and lie down and hope they come up with something interesting. Because if we say to them, it's fantastic, that rhythm at the start, forget the last bit, extend the rhythm at the start, why not? You know, I'd like to see our role a bit as a commissioning editor, where we're working against them and with them. We should be a learning process for them and, you know, valuable for the audience. But what's interesting, and we looked at their scores and said, my God, this is an intelligent bunch. And then meeting them, they're already talking about Bert Whistle and Penderecki and Xenakis and Steve Reich and so on. So they are pretty literate. Several of them have already thought about theatre in Bert Whistle, for example. So there's plenty to work with.
Peter Weigold on the day that the six winning composers first met and began mulling over their commissions. Some of them will be performed in the Royal Albert Hall, so to get the creative juices flowing, they crossed the road from the Royal College of Music to have a look at the hall. For some of them, it was their first time. They heard the end of a rehearsal by the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra, and they experienced it from several different places in the hall, ending up high in the gallery.
I hadn't really considered what an amazing venue it is. It's already got such an atmosphere about it, you don't really, well, it does some of the work for you. So I was kind of surprised. I kind of felt like I might want to do the one here as opposed to one of the other options, because it's just such a great space.
It'll be really exciting to be able to use the different levels, as well as, you know, the whole circular shape of the hall, which is very rare.
It's wonderful how it sounds so different when we're downstairs and when we're upstairs, and it's just amazing. The acoustics are amazing, and it would be great to write a piece for this place one day.
I wasn't aware how much space there was up in this very top bit, the gallery. I think that might be a fun thing to play with. The levels and the circular structure, it's fantastic for a kind of spatial project. It's going to be really, really good fun.
Well, back now to that Proms Plus event last Monday at the Royal College of Music, where several of the winning pieces were performed. The next is a work for solo piano called Word in Edgeways, and winning 16-year-old composer Benjamin Weatherfield explains his title.
I just had to write it in a very short space of time, using the same material as a piece that wasn't able to be performed. And so just I had to sort of, in a way, get a word in edgeways, just quickly, with life speeding by, quickly get it out there in a playable format. And I guess it also works as sort of, it's almost kind of a short statement or even a word, as opposed to an extended paragraph or whatever of music. And I guess it's somewhat edgy, I don't know. I had very little time to compile it, and actually the initial performance, which I then wrote down, was a lot of it was improvised. It was all there, but I just sort of pieced it together in a kind of freer way, and maybe that comes through in how it sounds, I don't know.
What makes you want to write and create new music?
I guess there's a kind of guilt if you're not creating, and not, for me anyway, if you're not preserving things floating around. And I don't know, it's sort of the idea of just transcribing what's already there, and you're kind of catching up with potential music, and that often leads me to write a piece or whatever.
Word in Edgeways, a solo piano piece by Benjamin Weatherfield, 16-year-old winner of this year's BBC Proms Inspire competition. Word in Edgeways was performed last Monday at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall in the Royal College of Music by John Reed, pianist and member of the Aurora Orchestra. Well, this is the Inspire competition's 10th year. It began life as the Guardian Proms competition, and one of the very first winners was a 14-year-old called Alyssa Firsova. She's the daughter of two composers, Dmitry Smirnov and Elena Firsova. And now, at 24, she has a commission to write a new piece for this year's Proms, a long way to come from what turns out to be a surprise win back in 2001.
I wrote a very short little piano piece called Le Pavot, which was part of a Purcell School composition project, but I never knew that the piece was then sent off to the competition. Alison Cox, who's the head of composition, sent it off without telling me, and
wow.
I had a huge surprise, because at the time, I remember I was playing football with some friends on the lawn, and this girl comes up to me, a friend of mine, and she says, "Alyssa, you know, there's some terrible news. Alison Cox really needs to speak to you." And I got so worried, so I ran inside in my football gear and come up to Alison Cox, and she's all there, red in the face, sort of going, "Alyssa, I've got some terrible news for you." I said, "What?" She says, "You've just won the BBC Guardian Proms Young Composer Competition."
What a wonderful surprise.
So I was really shocked. And then the next thing I knew, I had to come here to the BBC studios and record the piece for Radio 3.
So what effect did it then go on to have, having won it? I mean, what opportunities did it open up, or how did it change your confidence?
Well, the greatest thing was it was a very immediate effect. As soon as the piece was recorded and broadcast on BBC Radio 3, I received a letter at school from the ABRSM saying...
That's the Associated Board of the Royal Schools of Music.
That's it, that's the one. And they commissioned me, it was a very official letter, "We're commissioning you a piece for cello and piano for our Spectrum series." And that one was Spectrum for cello. And it was I was then the youngest of 16 British composers to be commissioned that piece, among Sally Beamish, Gavin Bryars, all these sort of big names. So that was my first commission, and which basically led on to a series of more commissions.
Ending up with right now in this yep. BBC Prom season, you have a commission for the prom on the 14th of August, which is part of Bach Day.
Yes.
And you've made a sort of semi-transcription of a Bach work.
That's it, yeah. And this news again, I really still cannot believe it. I mean, 23 now, and just... My mother was, I think, about 46 when she received a commission for the proms. So we're having a little bit of competition in the family, which is quite funny.
So what would your advice be to the young composers who've all won this competition so far in moving forward? Mm. If you had one piece of advice for them to make them, you know, make the most of this opportunity, what would it be?
I would definitely say that try and get into an environment, the Purcell School was great for that, where you can find people that would want to play your music. Ask them for advice of how is the best way to write for their instrument. Allow them to play for you, and hopefully if you get people to want to play your music, then others will hear it and want to play it too, and that way you can just continue on your journey.
Alyssa Firsova. Well, as we heard, her memory was that her teacher, Alison Cox, who's head of composition at the Purcell School, had sent in her piece without telling her, which makes a great story. But at last Monday's Proms Plus event, I had the chance to ask Alison herself.
Well, I don't know if it's true or not, because normally I make absolutely sure that the young people who enter for the competition are happy about it. And normally it's their own initiative that encourages them to put in their own pieces. But I do think that the BBC Inspire programme is the most fantastic opportunity for young people, not only for those who win, but also for those who have the opportunity to take part in the programme throughout the other stages. And I know so many young composers who've spoken highly of it and who've learned such a lot from it. For example, I'm a tutor on the Sound and Music Summer School for Young Composers that we run at the Purcell School now. And so many of the young composers that come on this course have been inspired by Inspire. And they bring along their works that they've started and they take it further with us as well. And I just think this is something that really makes a great deal of difference to young people, especially in parts of the country where they don't necessarily always have the opportunity to hear their works played. I think to bring something to them and to give them these kind of opportunities to unlock their ideas is something that all composers need.
So perhaps it should be called Inspire Young Composers Opportunities rather than Inspire Young Composers Competition. I mean, I wonder, you know, the word competition, it's a slightly dodgy one, but do you feel that in general they are useful things for young composers?
I have two minds about competitions. On one hand, I think they're fantastic for the ones who win them, and I think they do encourage young people to stretch themselves further. But on the other hand, in a competition, you get a few happy winners, and you sometimes get quite a lot more unhappy losers. And that's where I feel competitions are sometimes, I have a few question marks about them. But what I feel is so good about the Inspire programme is that it encourages everybody. You know, it's not just about the winners, it's about everybody who takes part. And I love the fact that you have a day where you invite everybody who's taken part to come and experience the different opportunities that you give them, which is what I think it's really all about.
Alison Cox, Head of Composition at the Purcell School in London. She was there at the Royal College of Music on Monday during the Proms Plus event to support her winning students. And as she said, Inspire doesn't just look for winners. There's also an open workshop for anyone who entered the competition to come along and take part in earlier on that day. The project leader for that was one of the competition judges, Stephen Montague.
Well, it's called Inspire Day, so we're trying to inspire young composers to write magnificent pieces. Now, that's a big X factor. I wish I knew how to write a magnificent piece. So what we're doing is actually having my team of Joby Burgess, Genevieve Wilkins, Michael Henry, and Jules Heppel as my performers, and we just did a piece that involved ideas from the young composers as to how we were going to do this piece. We're now going to divide up into groups, and we will put together material and bring that back into Maida Vale 1 in a couple of hours' time, and then we will try to make magic, putting all these various disparate elements together into one tremendous piece, I hope.
Well, as part of their Inspire Day, the young people involved were inspired by Stephen Montague's team to improvise. Here they are with Julian Heppel creating a woodland scene.
So, could the forest of birds start fluttering very quietly now? Very quietly. Very quietly. And you walk into the woodland and it's slightly more dense, slightly more birds, getting a little bit louder. And it's getting a little bit darker, maybe there's some bats hovering at the back. Maybe that bat disappeared in the little woodland. So there we are. You can hear some twigs breaking, maybe, quietly. Very nice. And then all of a sudden we get the biggest, most enormous chord you've ever heard. And this makes the birds go crazy and they'll go really loud. And then a really, really gentle, calm, quiet chord. Birds disappear for a second, but the chord keeps going.
That was recorded on Monday during the Inspire Day open workshop at the BBC's Maida Vale studios. Later on in the day, and we're back at the Royal College of Music for the Proms Plus event, at which many of the winning and all of the highly commended compositions were performed by the Aurora Orchestra. And the next of our composers is the youngest of the lot. He's 14, he's called Sebastian Black, and he's already involved in Aldborough Young Musicians programme. His piece is for two pianos, rather unusually handled.
The first piano is on stage, and then I have a second piano, which is surreptitiously placed behind the scenes to spatialise the sound and also to echo the first piano.
Did you write it for a particular event or hall in mind?
Yeah, I wrote it for the Britain Studio in Snape, which is quite large, and there was also a large offstage area. It's a good acoustic, but it was interesting just to play with it and to see if I could make the space much more resonant than it actually was by having, in fact, two pianos as a little joke.
There are musical references in your piece. Where do they come from?
I picked the musical references from various experiences and things which I've heard during the weeks leading up to the actual compositional process. So the first reference is from Peter Maxwell Davis's St. Thomas Wake. It's a foxtrot, a sort of very jaunty foxtrot, which is quite very different from, I suppose, the majority of the piece. Then the second reference is from Wagner's Das Rheingold. It is in the score much faster, and I've just slowed it down so it sounds very, very resonant and distant. And the third reference is from Chopin's First Ballade, which I had heard in a rehearsal room, and I thought I would put it in there too.
Sebastian Black. His piece for two pianos is called Postscriptum, and as well as the spatial element of having the offstage piano, there's also a dramatic twist towards the end as the onstage pianist flounces off. In the score, it says the piece should begin with 8 seconds of silence. Postscriptum by 14-year-old winning composer Sebastian Black. It was performed at the Royal College of Music, on stage by John Reed and off stage by Ian Farrington. As director of the Aurora Orchestra, the conductor Nicholas Collin is responsible for fixing the band for the concert, which included both winning and highly commended works. And he has to work quite fast.
Yeah, it's just about enough time. It gives us about a month to look at all the pieces.
And you, I mean, presumably you then run around putting together the right instrumentations and groups of players, because they're not written for your ensemble. They're just sent in speculatively as competition entries.
Absolutely. And last year we had a piece for six clarinets. You know, this year we had two guitars and quite a bit of percussion. And yeah, we just sort of delve into our ranks of players and find the correct personnel, which is quite exciting though, just to see the different varieties of lineups that each piece warrants.
And what about the general, don't want to put you on the spot, but what about the general standard of writing, both in terms of the way in which, you know, the scores are presented to you and the kind of ideas that these young composers are exploring?
Generally astonishing, really amazing, and I think that's something that all the players comment upon. We play lots of new music with Aurora, and I find some composers with 20 years age on these young composers who have less innovation actually in the way they write. I think they're unfettered at that age and they just write what they want to write. I mean, obviously some of the pieces lack that care and experience when it comes to notating or presenting the final score, but that's sort of what we're here to help with as well. So during the process and rehearsals, we can make suggestions as to what they could improve. Some really basic things, actually, often that once they know, they can just go away and sort out. And so that's quite a fulfilling process for us.
Nicholas Collin, and we're about to hear him conducting his Aurora Orchestra in the last of our six winners of the BBC Proms Inspire competition 2010. This one is by the 18-year-old Jonathan Woolger, and it's called Dead Sea Scrolls.
I saw the scrolls themselves in a museum, and I was fascinated by the idea of these tiny little fragments of parchment and of text having to be combined to make the whole, which is a painstaking process, it took many years, and how to reflect that musically, so there's little musical fragments that get pieced together in different ways, and sometimes they clash or fit together nicely.
What are the composers, the sorts of music that you listen to and that influence your writing?
I probably have a huge influence from Stravinsky. I think he's a composer's composer, for sure. But also on the contemporary scene, I listen to a lot of Adez and Anderson and take a lot of inspiration from their approach to composition, which is much less rigid than some of the hard modernist viewpoints of the latter part of the 20th century, I think.
What is it that makes you want to be a composer?
Oh, heavens. It's probably, ultimately, the ability to affect people in some way, maybe make them feel something or thought, or I think it's almost the power of being able to affect an audience and maybe even control them, and that's very appealing. But really, I'm just trying to make good art. I hope it's not too contrived.
Dead Sea Scrolls by the 18-year-old Jonathan Woolgar, played by members of the Aurora Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Collin. And that recording took place in the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall of the Royal College of Music last Monday as part of the BBC Proms Inspire Day. The programme was presented by Sarah Moore-Peach. If you'd like more information about the Inspire competition and the surrounding events, have a look at the Proms website. That's at bbc.co.uk/proms/2010 and follow the links to Young Composers. Well, tomorrow evening we'll be hearing some young players when the National Youth Orchestra gives its prom. They start with The Sorcerer's Apprentice, then they'll play Fantasias by Julian Anderson, and the second half of the concert will be a performance of Symphonie Fantastique by Berlioz. And that is all live here on BBC Radio 3 at 7:30.